I read a statistic some time ago. It said that the average man thinks about sex about once every 2 minutes. That is a sobering statistic. But I know I have your attention now. They had no statistics from women. I don't know why. But I thought to myself, if that's true, then behind the scenes in people's lives, there's a whole lot going on that they do not talk about. And that's absolutely right. And yet, when we come to the Lord, He says to us, there's no area of your life that I do not understand, right down to the depth of your soul, right down to the issues that you will not talk to anybody else about. And that brings us to some of the surprising realities in God's Word about sexuality. And we're going to be in a minute here in Proverbs chapter 7, which is the classic proverb chapter on the subject. And we're going to spend the whole evening in this one. I notice there is a good turnout this evening. This is often the case. But there are some surprises in store for people who, when they first come to know the Lord, have some preconceptions about, pardon the pun, about sexuality. There is a prevailing thought in people's minds, first of all, that God is prudish on the subject of sexuality, which of course is not true. If you know His Word at all, you know He's not. In Proverbs, it talks a lot about it. In the Song of Solomon, it talks a lot about it. In the New Testament, it speaks of it. God created sexuality. He blessed it. He said it was good. It was part of life before the fall. And yet, after the fall, we've done something in the area of sexuality that has caused it to become one of the greatest, if not the greatest, single area of stumbling in the entire human race, all of human history. Sexuality is something that human beings have messed up, but it was originally very, very good. God is not a prude about it. I won't read the passages, but because we already looked at them, but in Proverbs 5, beginning in verse 19, he talks about it. And you remember where, in that particular passage, he talks graphically about sexual love in marriage. And he advises the young man in the passage. He says, I want you to have a happy sex life in your marriage. I want you to be rejoicing in it. I want it to be intoxicating to you. He actually uses the Hebrew word for intoxicating. And some of you are reading that passage right now, aren't you? In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, in 1 Corinthians 7, the first five verses, warns married couples not to abstain from sexual contact over long periods of time. They were doing it in the Corinthian church because they thought it was spiritual, and Paul said, well, you can do that for short periods of time for fasting or whatever, but you mustn't keep that up because it's part of being married, and it's a good part of being married. God is not a prude about sex. He's got a lot to say about it, and He's got a lot of good to say about it. Now, the other great surprise to some people is that God also doesn't see sex the way the world does. On the one hand, some people think that God's a prude, and they're surprised to find out He's not. On the other hand, some people think that God created sexuality, and it's up to us to do whatever we want with it, and anything we do is perfectly fine with Him because He created us that way. And you hear this kind of logic in our world sometimes. Well, God just created me this way, and therefore, it doesn't matter how I channel the sexuality in my life. It doesn't matter what I do because God created me this way. You hear this a lot in the gay community these days. And it's really blatantly false. It's just not true. But you also hear it among people who are supposedly Christians. I am shocked as a Christian pastor through the years to see the increase, not decrease, but the increase of the percentage of Christians who do not understand that sexual purity is actually square one of genuine discipleship, and who have supposedly come to the Lord, been baptized, and are going to church over a long period of time, and I'm talking months and years, before their sex life gets straightened out with God's Word. In other words, they're sleeping around or living together outside of being married. I'm amazed by this, and yet I shouldn't be. In a way, I'm amazed. In another way, I've learned to kind of take it in stride because it comes up so often in our culture. But the Lord is far from neutral on the subject about this. In fact, he's so clear in the New Testament that, again, it's a surprise. I remember one time reading a passage, which we're going to turn to in just a minute, but reading it out loud to somebody, and they sat there across the table from me. This is a full-grown adult who'd been a Christian supposedly for some time, and they were shocked. No one had ever read to them the passage that we're going to read right now, which is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. I thought, where have you been going to church? And I was hoping they were not going to say Trail Fellowship. And they didn't. Praise the Lord. I said, well, come here for a while. You'll hear this verse. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. God does care that sexuality be done the way he intended it. Furthermore, he cares so much that it's intimately connected to your discipleship. 1 Thessalonians 4:1. Finally then, brethren, we request and exhort you in the Lord Jesus that as you receive from us instruction as to how you ought to walk and to please God, just as you actually do, so that you may excel still more. In other words, you are walking with the Lord, but we want you to be careful of some things, and we want you to continue to excel in walking with the Lord, for you know what commandments we gave to you by the authority of the Lord Jesus. For this is the will of God, your sanctification, or the idea that you become more like the Lord. Your sanctification, that is, and he says specifically in this case that you abstain from sexual immorality. The Greek word porneia, we get our word pornographic from it. It means sex outside of marriage, simply. Before you get married, after a marriage has been dissolved, and you think, well, you know, my marriage is dissolved and I can still fool around out there. No, that's porneia. While you are married, involved with someone that you're not married to, that's porneia. While you are married, involved in pornography at any level, that's porneia. I mean, now you're seeing how importantly he views the subject. He says, this is God's will. What is God's will? This is God's will. Step one, square one of discipleship, sexual purity. In a world that doesn't think that's important at all, and as a matter of fact, pushes for the opposite at all times. This is God's will, your sanctification, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you know how to possess his own vessel, which I take to mean your own body, in sanctification and honor, in other words, holiness before God, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God. People who don't know God view sexuality completely differently than people who do know God. Verse 6, and that no man transgress or defraud his brother in this matter, because the Lord is the avenger in these things. Now, that's a very interesting way to put it, isn't it? The avenger, the person who brings vengeance. He says, do not take this lightly. Just as we told you before, and we solemnly warned you. I mean, the words just don't get any stronger than this, anywhere in the New Testament, about anything. About anything. I mean, you talk about any sin in the whole Bible, the words don't get any stronger than his warnings about sexual immorality, even though he says sex is good. And within marriage, it's to be honored and to be entered into. Outside of marriage, he says it's a killer. He solemnly warned you. Verse 7, God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, which is another sexual term, by the way, in the original. It means sexual impurity. But he's called us to be holy. He's called us to be like the Lord. So consequently, he who rejects this is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you. And I want you to remember that, because there are a lot of people who claim to know God today who are flat point blank rejecting this. I mean, they'll take this verse and they will simply say it does not apply to them. But it does. It does. And it's square one. It is the beginning of discipleship. And if you've been a Christian for more than a day, you should know this already. It should be in your soul. And as a matter of fact, if you've been a Christian for more than a day, it is in your soul, and it's possible you're not listening to it, but it's there. Turn to another passage, and this is another one that you might have thought I was going to turn to, if you know your New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Immorality was as rampant in those days as it is now, and that's why the Christians were so different. They were known to be different on this subject than the world around them. Verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 6. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me. I will not be mastered by anything. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. But God will do away with both of them. But the body is not for sexual immorality. It's for the Lord. Your body belongs to the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. And see, what they were saying was, sex is just like eating. It's just something that your body does, and it doesn't really matter. That's the way the Greeks viewed it. And underneath that false logic, they were engaging in all kinds of sexual immorality. And by the way, a lot of people today are back to that same false logic. More and more people are buying that same false logic. It doesn't really matter. It's just about your body, just like eating food. It's not a big deal. It's just a regular old drive that everybody has. And so why is it such a big deal? Well, God explains through the Apostle Paul why it's such a big deal right here. He says, yeah, it's true that food is of no consequence, but it's not true that sex is of no consequence. Because your body actually belongs to the Lord, verse 14, and God has not only raised the Lord, but he's going to raise your body up too. That means there's a continuity between your body now and the resurrection body you have. And what it also means is your body now doesn't belong to you, it belongs to God. He goes on. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? May it never be. He's talking here about ritual prostitution, which was very common in the pagan world. They had ritual prostitutes at the temples, and in order to worship these various pagan deities, you went and had sex with the prostitutes. Now, you can see why some of these religions were very popular. Truly, truly. And why, when a person came to Christ in the first century, this was the very first thing they learned. It was right in their face immediately. And in fact, before they came to Christ, they would have to know ahead of time, if I come to the Lord, it's going to mean that I'm going to remain sexually pure unless I'm married, and then I'll have a good sex life, hopefully, after I'm married. But I am not going to engage in the normal sexual activities of the culture around me. Big shock for these people and a very great difference. He says, am I supposed to do this? Is my body such that I can do this with it? He says, may it never be. Verse 16. Don't you know that the one who joins himself to a harlot is one body with her? And here he quotes Genesis 2. The two shall become one flesh. There is some mysterious unity that occurs that we don't understand. We think we understand sexuality, and we don't understand it, you guys. We don't understand it. God says, would you trust me that you don't understand it, that there's some sort of union that happens that you don't comprehend, and that I'm telling you to abstain from this in an illicit manner? I'm telling you to stay away from illicit sex for a really good reason. Verse 17, but the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with the Lord. So flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own, that you have been bought with a price? Therefore glorify God with your body. Well, those two passages from the New Testament should cinch it. And yet it doesn't, because our world is so unwise and continues to pump us full of more temptation than we can handle, it seems. And that's what brings us to Proverbs chapter 7. Let's turn to Proverbs 7, because Proverbs 7 is the proverb about this subject. And you might say, well, is wisdom literature, Proverbs, should it have anything to do with sexuality? Answer, absolutely. Your spiritual life is impacted by what you think about sexually and by your activities sexually. Your spiritual life is deeply impacted by them. And furthermore, your human life and the texture of your human life is scarred permanently. Scarred permanently if this area is not taken care of. Now, as I say that, let me mention something here. Because the last time I talked on this, and I do it whenever we're in a passage that talks about it as we go through the scriptures, I had people afterwards asking, does God ever restore? You know, I mean, in my life, they would say, I've goofed up in this area. Does God ever restore? Yes, he does. And that is the wonder of grace. He does restore. But folks, the scars on the soul remain. God turns those into something he can use. But you can so ruin the texture of your life by misuse of sexuality, that's why it's found in the wisdom literature, not just in the Torah, not just in the commandments, not just in the prophetic books, not just in the New Testament letters, although it's found in every one of those textures as well. It's found in every one of those types of literature. It's also found in wisdom literature. It's found in Proverbs. Now, remember what wisdom is about. It's how to make your life work. Remember that? Wisdom is how to make your life work. That's the simplest reality in what Proverbs is all about. And one of the ways that people make their lives break is by not paying attention on the issue of sexuality. And that's why Proverbs has a bit to say about it. In fact, a whole chapter dedicated to it. So we're in Proverbs chapter 7. And when you think of wisdom, one of the very first things you ought to think of is the state of your mind and your activities with regard to sexuality. Now, chapter 7 is an interesting chapter. It's kind of unique in the chapters of Proverbs because it is not just a disconnected series of pieces of advice like so many of the chapters of Proverbs. This is an actual story. It's almost like a parable. And it's a story written or spoken by a wise person. We'll get introduced to him in just a moment. But let me point out ahead of time, before we read it, it's a story about two people, a man and a woman, and they both have really bad character, but in different ways. The man is a spineless fool. Okay? He's young. He is a spineless fool. And the woman is a deceitful shrew. Okay, so these are bad people. You don't want anything to do with either one of these people. In fact, we're going to learn a little bit about how to be and some wisdom about these things at the end of this from the fact of the character of these two people. So it's a sad story. It does not have a happy ending. Watch for this. And notice that they are both immoral. Sometimes when people read this passage, they blame everything on the woman. And we're going to find out that that actually isn't the way this is to be understood. They blame everything on the woman, but that's not actually the way it is. Both of these people are immoral. But they're immoral in slightly different ways. And as their lives come in contact with each other, they ruin each other's lives as a result. And their life doesn't work, and that's why the writer, Solomon, says this is not wisdom, so learn from this, he says. Okay? Now, the first few verses introduce us to the wise person. We'll read the first five. My son, keep my words, treasure my commandments within you. Keep my commandments and live. And my teaching is the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. And call understanding your intimate friend. And make it a science. And when you do, when you say, I want wisdom and I want understanding and I want to know how to make my life work, and you come to God and you say, show me how to do this, Lord, then it'll keep you away from something that will kill you faster than anything else. Sexual immorality. Verse 5. These things will keep you from an adulteress. And that's how he personifies the immorality, the adulteress. From the foreigner who flatters with her words. By foreigner, he means there a woman who is not committed to the Lord. He's talking about a woman whose life is completely outside the bounds of what God wants. He says this kind of wisdom will keep you. By the way, there are kind of two different kinds of people in the world when it comes to this. One kind of person says, I will observe and I will learn. That's this guy. That's this person. Look at verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked out through the lattice, and I saw among the naive, among the simple-minded, among the foolish, I discerned among the youths a young man who lacked judgment or lacked sense. I saw a little idiot out there as I looked out my window. Now let me point something out. There are two kinds of people. There are people who see the idiots, and there are people who are the idiots. Okay? And the difference between the two is that one looks out and says, I want wisdom and I'm going to learn from other people's mistakes. And the other one says, not me. I just want to live life to the hilt and I'll learn from my own mistakes. Now you decide which one you want to be. And the younger you are right now, the more important that decision is right now. Although it's never too late to really screw your life up, and never forget that. Okay? Remember Samson. It's never too late to make a really bad decision. But if you're young and you're listening to what's being said here, you decide whether you want to be the kind of person who has to learn from all of your own mistakes, or you're the kind of person who can look out and say, you know, I have observed some things in other people's lives that I do not want to happen to me. And I've decided I'm going to go a different way. Well, see, this man who tells the story is the wise man. He's the one with character in the story, and he's the one who tells the story. So now we move into the story. We meet the two. We meet the idiot, the spineless fool, and we meet the deceptive shrew, the woman. I looked out the window, and I saw among the naive, among the youths, a young man lacking in sense. Passing through the street near her corner, her referring to the adulteress that he brought up in verse 5, near her corner, he takes the way to her house. And by the way, that Hebrew word means he makes a step in that direction. What is not happening is this kind of doofus guy walking along and not paying attention. That's not what's happening. It appears that he's not paying attention, but he knows where he wants to put himself. He knows where he's going. And furthermore, it's nighttime, late at night. It says, in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, in the darkness. There's a progression there. It's becoming dark. This young man is walking down a street that he knows there's a prostitute out there, and she's going to be looking for business. And he makes a decision to go down that street. Now, as we work through this, I'm going to mention five things. So if you're a note taker, watch what happens in this. And just watch the progression of this young idiot and how his life is altered permanently. First of all, he puts himself in the position of temptation. He makes a decision to walk down there. He puts himself in the position of temptation. And he does it at exactly the time and on the street where he knows she's liable. Do you ever notice how people sometimes, you ever heard of plausible deniability? Do you know what plausible deniability is? It's something politicians use when they know they got to tell somebody to do something really bad, but then later they have to be able to deny it plausibly. Plausible deniability. It's a rationale whereby you can say, I didn't mean to do that, when in reality, you intended all along to do it. That's exactly where this guy is. He's taking the steps down this street, and he is purposely putting himself in a situation that he knows is going to be more than he can handle. So, but that's what he wants. He wants something that's more than he can handle. Secondly, when she comes out, look at verses 10 to 13, she dominates, he lets her dominate his attention. Verse 10, behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. There was a special robe that they wore, there was special clothing, and there is today, by the way. Any city that you go down certain streets, you can find the hookers, you can find the streetwalkers. And she's dressed in a certain way that lets everybody know that she's a hooker. And cunning of heart, she's got an agenda. She is boisterous and rebellious. The Hebrew words mean she is loud and uncaring about that which is appropriate in terms of behavior. Have you ever known anybody like that? I mean, a person who is sort of in your face in terms of moral issues, in terms of what is common decency, they're just in your face about it, and they don't care who knows, and they don't care who cares about it. They're just kind of, well, that's what this woman is, isn't it? She's dressed very seductively and flashy, and it's very obvious that she doesn't care. And her feet do not remain at home. Well, that's an understatement. But it's an interesting idiom. It's an interesting way for them to put it. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets and now in the squares and lurks by every corner. You get the picture of ting, 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 you know, just kind of lurking, you know, like a creature waiting for someone to hurt, lurking. Verse 13. So she seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face, she says to him, and we'll read what she says in just a moment. But note right now, he lets her have his entire attention. And that's exactly what he wants. Her clothing and her behavior are a tip-off as to the kind of woman she is, but he does not care. It's actually why he's walking down there. He will be able to pretend later, oh, well, she just seduced me. But he's letting her do this. And he's allowing her to dominate, completely dominate, his field of vision. She comes right up to him. The look of her, the way she comes up and kisses him out of the blue. When was the last time you were walking down the street and a woman walked up and just grabbed you and kissed you? That does not happen every day. In your dreams, pal. Now, see, he should have known at that point. But does he? Does he say, you know, this is really outlandish. This is weird. Why is this woman coming on to me? Maybe there's something wrong here. He doesn't see that. Sort of the anesthetic has set in to his brain. Third, verses 14 to 21, watch the progression now. Remember, he put himself in the position of temptation, and then he allows himself to be dominated. She dominates his attention, grabs him, dominates his attention. Third, he lets her begin to influence his thinking, verses 14 to 21. She says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows. Oh, how very spiritual. Thank you very much. I went to church this morning. That's nice. I've paid my vows. Therefore, I've come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. Oh, I've been looking all my life for you. I'm looking all over for you. And she comes up. You know how flattering it is to be sought out. Huh? to have someone say, oh, you're the only one for me. And they say, oh, I've come all the way to follow you, to come to be with you. That's immensely flattering. It's very difficult for a man or a woman to resist that sort of thing. So she starts to speak to him. So now it's progressed from just him being on the street. Then he sees her and she dominates. He allows her to dominate his attention. Now he allows her to speak to him, and her logic and her words are beginning now to influence him. He's allowing her to influence him. Now watch the progression as it begins to move. This is happening rapidly in the story. In real life, when you fall into immorality, it happens more slowly than this, but it's the same progression. You put yourself in a situation where you know it's going to be very difficult for you, but you know that's where you want to be, and then you allow someone to grab your attention, and even after you know that it's the wrong thing to do, you still allow that to happen. And then you begin to think along the lines of the kind of weird thinking that goes on in a situation like that. She says, oh, I've been seeking you, I've been looking for you. I've spread my couch with coverings and with colored linens of Egypt. I've sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Which, you know, doesn't really, that's not a real big deal for us, you know, all that on the bed. But that, in those days, hey man, that was cool. That was very sexy stuff there, you know. And we're going, is this supposed to be like really exciting, you know? You gotta wash this bed, you know. We would say that, but they don't, that, it was the opposite for them. This is very sexy. Now, see, we read this, and this is the problem, you guys. When we read the Bible, we don't understand that it actually does translate into our culture, because we read stuff like this, and we think to ourselves, that doesn't make sense to me. But that we didn't live back then. You know, other things make sense to you. There are other sights and smells and music and lighting that all move in the same direction, you see. Okay, they're just different. They're just part of our culture, rather than what she's describing here. But you got to understand, it's the same essential dynamic, just different chemicals. Okay? But the same dynamic. She says, come on, come on, this will be fun. Let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. Now, this is one of the passages that tells you that God is not a prude. The Hebrew words here are graphic. Not rude and not crude, but very, very graphic. They mean to be absolutely sated with lovemaking. Absolute, until you are exhausted all night long. That's what it's talking about here. You say, oh, it says that in the Bible? Yes, it says that in the Bible. And that's what she's saying. That's what she's offering. And then she says, my husband's not home. The man is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. Now, her logic is progressing, and she's saying, essentially, we won't get caught, which is a lie. He's gone on a long journey. He's taken a big bag of money with him. And at full moon, he'll come home. So he could be gone, you know, a couple of weeks off on this business trip. Which also tells you, by the way, if he took a big bag of money, she is a woman who's fairly well-to-do. And she does not have to do this to make a living. She's not a poverty-stricken streetwalker who, because of being sold into slavery, has to do this. She's doing this for other reasons. We don't know what they are, but I'm going to mention some possibilities in a minute. So she says, come on, think like me. Think like me. You ever hang around with a person that you know is wrong the first time you talk to them, and then after you hang out with them for a while, you begin to think like they do? That's a very dangerous thing when you allow another person through their words to begin to move you in a direction that you know is wrong, and you can still feel yourself slipping down there, but there's something inside of you that says, I don't want to stop. See, that's the problem. That's the problem with this young idiot. So she's talking sweet talk to him, and he's not old enough to understand that she's basically lying to him. He's too young to understand that he's getting taken advantage of, that he's going to be hurt in this thing. So she persuades him, verse 21, through her talk, with her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. And let me make it clear, seduction happens in talk. It does. And it goes both ways. It goes both ways. Men can seduce women by talk, by sheer talk. And women can seduce men by talk. Never underestimate the sensual power of words. They are very powerful. You be careful. Be careful what you talk about. Depending on the situation you're in and who you're talking to, because words are powerful. They touch the soul much more than people think they do. She persuades this man, this young man. So now he was in a position of temptation. He allowed her to dominate his attention. Now he's allowed her to influence his thinking. Have you ever noticed, too, when you know, in The mind is the servant of the will. When the will wants something, the mind finds a way to find it, and it makes it appear very compelling why you have to do what it is you always wanted to do anyway. Okay? So she's talking. He knows what he wants, and he's literally letting her talk him into it, and he's lying to himself, basically, thinking that it's going to be okay. That's how it works. Influences his thinking. And then here's the fourth thing that happens. He lets her actually control his actions. Verse 22. Suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter. Now that is a colorful line, okay? Now, except that you notice the word suddenly. Actually, in Hebrew it does say suddenly, but is it all that sudden? I mean, look at the process. Is it really that sudden? It appears to be sudden, but you know what's happened at this point? There's a point of no return when it comes to sexual temptation. There's a point at which now kind of critical mass is reached in the chemistry between a man and a woman. And once that critical mass is reached, suddenly it takes on a whole new dynamic. And that's what he's describing here. There was a process that was going along. There was a point at which he could have turned his back. He could have said no, but he didn't, and he didn't, and he didn't. And then all of a sudden, boom, now there's a point at which he cannot say no. And he uses the idiom of an ox being led to the slaughter. Now, why does he use that idiom? What is the picture of an ox being led to the slaughter? Well, oxen are not known for their brightness, so there's a little something for you right there. This little fella is like kind of like a box of rocks, basically. Secondly, an ox can be led, even though it's a huge, powerful animal that could easily run away from the man who's leading him, can be led with a very small line to where he will be killed. Because he is ignorant, he's stupid. He's ignorant, and he will allow a person to literally say, come on, come on, come on, come on, taking him to the slaughterhouse. If the ox knew where this guy was taking him, he would bolt. He would do anything to get away. And you want to know something? He would get away. The ox would get away if he only knew. And that's the picture that's being drawn here. Here's a man who's allowed this to happen in his life to the point now where he can be drawn with this tiny little thing, this tiny little bit of pressure in this direction. And he's going to the slaughterhouse. He's going to get killed. As an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool. It's like he's entrapped. It's like he's in handcuffs, is the idea. Until an arrow pierces through his liver. Ooh, yeah. A hunter with an arrow has made a good shot if they strike the liver, because it's a mortal wound. It's a mortal wound. That's what he's getting at. It's a mortal wound, but doesn't kill you instantly. Are you getting the picture? See, in Hebrew, you want to think about stuff like that. When you're reading this kind of poetry, you want to think of the picture. It's a mortal wound that doesn't kill you right away. You bleed to death, and there's no way to stop it once the liver has been lacerated by an arrow, in those days especially. There's no way to stop it. You bleed to death, but you don't die right away. And that's the picture he's drawing out of this young idiot and not being able to control his sex life. As a bird hastens to the snare, another great picture. So he does not know. It will cost him his life. And so the story closes with this woman leading this young, dumb kid off down into her room. And it's so sad. It is so tragic, because it's going to ruin him and it's going to ruin her. And he doesn't have the good sense to stop it. Then we go back to the storyteller. Now, therefore, my sons, listen to me. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. Many are the victims that she has cast down, and numerous are her slain. Her house is the way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. And he ends the story. Now, did you notice what happens? You put yourself in a position of temptation. You allow it to dominate your attention. There's something magic about sexual temptation. It does dominate your attention. And you know when you've been infatuated by somebody to the point where you're not thinking straight. That's the next phase. And then it influences your thinking. You start making excuses. You start rationalizing why it might be okay after all. And then there is a control. There's this critical mass, and the control of your actions actually is taken over pretty much by the other person. And then finally, this is the fifth one. He allows her to determine his destiny. That's what happens in the end. He allows her immorality to determine his destiny. Let me ask you something before we close, and I'm going to close with some advice, because we learn some things for both men and women, believe it or not, from these two terrible characters. We learn by contrast, and I'll talk about that with some advice for men and for women. But let me ask you something. You don't have to let on that this may be true, but are you anywhere in this process right now in your life? Are you anywhere in this process? Are you in a position where you know you're liable to be tempted? Maybe by the use of your computer? Maybe by the movies that you're watching? Maybe by the people you're hanging out with? Are you in a position where you know, and it kind of feels kind of good to be tempted like that, and so you kind of stay in that? Or have you moved somewhere further down in the process, where maybe even by now your thinking is starting to twist, so that even as I'm speaking, or even as you hear a Bible study on the subject, there's something inside of you saying, no, no, that couldn't be right, that couldn't be right, I must be okay after all, I shouldn't have to deal with this. And there's this little struggle going on the inside. Are you anywhere in that process? My friend, let me give you a piece of advice right now. If you're anywhere in this process, the only thing that you can do to extricate yourself from it is to repent immediately and get yourself out of there right now. Right now, today, tonight. Make the decision. Because the same ending that he makes here, that he describes, is the end you will find if you follow this course of action. It'll kill everything valuable to you. Can God restore? Yes, and many are the stories of God's restorative grace. But every single one of them will tell you, if I had it to do over, I would never have done that. So if you find yourself in this process, my friend, get out of it now. Trust the grace of God, and whatever it costs you, think in terms of that ox, if he knew where he was going, whatever it costs you, break out. Get out. Change what you're doing. Especially if you're a person who says you know the Lord. Now let me offer some advice here. Because we do learn some things. You know, in the Proverbs, you learn both by example and by contrast. So I want to start with some advice for women. And it's sort of straightforward advice, and I'm not going to belabor it. But let me mention three things that you learn from this woman. Number one, you have a real influence with men, so make it a good one. Women, young women, older women, let me tell you something that men won't tell you, probably. You have influence with men by virtue of being a female, by virtue of being attractive to men. You have influence with them. And never think that you do not have influence with them. You do, especially the men closest to you. Make it a good influence. You see how this woman uses her influence to get what she wants and to destroy the life of the man. Our world loves to have men and women fighting. It loves to have males and females at each other's throats, either that or trying to seduce each other. Anything but genuine harmony and a good impact on one another. But as Christians, ladies, you must be committed to understanding that you do have influence. So use your influence at every point to help the men in your life. You say, well, how can I do that? How can I use my influence? In a sense, how can I use the natural magnetism? And that's what I'm talking about here. The natural magnetism between male and female, which is created by God, and it's not evil in and of itself. How can a woman use that to influence positively? Let me give you a couple of thoughts on it. First, let it be known that you respect men who respect women. Let it be known that you respect men who respect women, and don't put up with disrespect, especially in the sexual realm. I'll repeat this in a minute, but you are an honorable person. And you do not have to put up with the kind of disrespect that some women actually put up with internally. Let it be known that you respect men. You say, well, will that help? Yes. I'll tell you something. Let me give you another secret that men won't tell you, and that is that most men will do what they think will receive admiration from women. Isn't that weird? But it's true. Now, the problem is they don't understand what that is, and so they end up doing what they think will receive admiration from other men, thinking that's what women want, and it doesn't work that way. But once they find out that the women they care about really admire and respect a certain lifestyle, you will see they won't let on. They won't just go and run after that lifestyle, but slowly there will be some changes. Do you ever notice how after guys get married, they sometimes change their attire? It gets cleaner and less wrinkly sometimes. And there's other positive changes that occur. Teeth get brushed. Hair gets combed. Deodorant is discovered. Various things like this. Now, why? Why do you suppose that is? It is the influence of the woman in their life. Don't underestimate that. Let it be known that you respect men who respect women. Here's another thing. Let it be known that you respect, and this is extremely important, let it be known that you respect and admire men who love Jesus Christ. You let that be known. And the magnetism that is part of all male and female relationships, to one extent or another, will become a positive force in the men that you know. Because they will say a couple of things. Maybe the guy's a creepazoid, and he doesn't love Jesus, and he finds out you do. What's that going to do? You tell me, what's it going to do? Well, he might be a church. There is a little missionary dating that occurs that way, but that's not what I have in mind. Some guys do come to church for that reason. If he really doesn't want the Lord, he's going to reject you. If you've let it be known that you respect men who love Jesus Christ, and you're having that kind of an impact, the kind of guy that doesn't love the Lord is going to stay away from you. Now, that'll be painful. That'll be painful for you, because everybody wants to be appreciated. But if you do that, what you'll do is you save yourself a world of hurt, because that's not the kind of guy you want hanging around anyway. In all the relationships that you have with males, make sure that they know that you appreciate and respect men who are mature and growing in Jesus Christ. And that goes for married women and unmarried women, young and old. Because that magnetism that God put between male and female can be used for good things if we will impact one another for Jesus. So remember your influence. You do have more influence than you think you do. Here's the second thing that we learned from this woman. You have visual appeal. So make it healthy. Did you notice her clothing attracts him? He is visually attracted to her, so make it healthy. Make sure that the visual look that you project is a look that does not hurt the men around you. The clothing, the way you talk, the way you walk, the way you act when you're around men. Be careful, because you have visual appeal and you can hurt the men around you. And that's exactly what this woman does. She hurts the men around her. You say, oh man, I shouldn't have to worry about that. Well, look at the wisdom literature. Look at the wisdom literature and be careful. Be careful what you wear. Be careful how you talk. It is good to be attractive. I've said many times, you know, if the barn needs painting, paint it. That's okay. But it is not good to it is not good to cross the line where you're not just being attractive, you've actually become seductive. And a young woman, a young unmarried woman, sometimes doesn't understand that. She doesn't understand the influence that she has, and she doesn't understand the visual appeal that she has, and she loves the attention she gets, especially from older guys. She loves that attention, and she thinks that attention is the same as respect, and it is not. It is not the same as respect, and it's not what you want. So, you have visual appeal. Make sure that it is a healthy kind of visual appeal. Here's the third thing you notice from this woman, you can learn by way of advice. You have honor. Do not sell yourself short. You have honor. Do not sell yourself short. Now, let me show you how it comes out of this passage. Because at first you wouldn't get that out of here. But listen, why would this married woman, fairly well situated in life, become a hooker at night while her husband's gone? I have no idea. It doesn't say. But I do know from observation and from counseling and from working with people through the years, 20 years of being a pastor, I do know that sometimes women looking for validation will sell themselves short in order to receive validation from men. And so here's what I'm telling you, and especially this is true if you are a young unmarried woman. You have honor. Do not sell yourself short. You have honor. Do not sell yourself short. Do not sell your physical self in order to have a man smile at you when you know full well it's wrong. It is not worth it. You wait Wait until you know you have the right relationship. Wait until you know you're getting married. And then you can say, okay, now I can think about this guy. Until then, my friend, be wise. Don't sell yourself short. And be aware that when you want the kind of validation that you think you're going to get by giving yourself away, when you want that kind of validation, that's okay, but you're getting it the wrong way. Now, I don't know why this woman did this, but I'll tell you, she's not alone in the world. I mean, there are millions of women who, you just change the clothing, change the situation, who might do something like this for all the wrong reasons. Do not sell yourself short. A piece of advice. You have more honor than that. You are worth more than that. And you don't have to put up with that. And if you're already putting up with it, and there are men in your life that treat you this way, my friend, get out of there. And if you need help getting out of there, you find a solid Christian to help you. They'll help you get out. Don't stay in that. You have more honor than that. So, you have real influence with men. Make sure it's a good influence. You have visual appeal. Make sure it's a healthy visual appeal. And you have honor. Don't sell yourself short. Now, men, here's three pieces of advice, and these might surprise you. Believe it or not, they might surprise you. Watch this little idiot and learn a couple things. Number one, your sex drive is your responsibility, not hers. Listen to this. Your sex drive is your responsibility. It's not hers. Isn't that interesting that in this thing, and you watch through the whole scripture, even though you find women who seduce men, you never see the man getting to blame it on the woman. This little guy is an idiot. From beginning to end, he's a fool. It's obvious in the whole story he's a fool, yet the woman seduces him. You know what that tells you? It tells you it's still his responsibility. That's what it means. It's still his responsibility. Your sex drive is your problem, gentlemen, not hers. There is an unwritten rule in American pagan society that says that a guy can get away with anything he can get away with. And it's up to the woman to say no. And that is not so in God's law. It is not so. It's up to the man to say no. He sets the tone. He sets the baseline morally in the relationship. I don't care if she takes her clothes off and chases you down the road, pal. I am not kidding you. You say, oh, how could you say such a thing in church? Well, it's in the Bible, actually. Remember Joseph and Potiphar's wife? That's exactly what happened to that guy. He worked for this rich guy's wife, and she came after him. And she said to him, the story is in Genesis 39, she said to him, she grabbed him. She said, come and lie with me. I mean, that's not like, you know, I don't know, what do you mean? It's not like that. She was after him. She did this over and over and over. He argues with her. He says, no way. I will not disgrace my own honor, your honor, and the honor of the man I work for, who's your husband. I will not do that. And she, one day, when everybody's gone, she comes out, grabs him, tries to wrestle him to the ground. Can you believe that? And he takes off and leaves his cloak in her hand, takes off in his skivvies, running down the road away from this woman. That's actually the right thing. You see, he was setting the baseline. He was setting the moral atmosphere in the relationship. Let me talk to some of you who are single. Gentlemen, you set the moral atmosphere in your relationship. If it is out of hand, it's because of you. If it's out of hand, it's because of you. You say, oh, yeah, but, you know, you just have no idea. You know, it's very difficult for me, and, you know, she's really sexy, and she comes on to me a lot. It's still your fault. You get no sympathy from me. I am a man. I know. It's your fault. You can say no, and you should, because your sex drive is your responsibility. It is not her responsibility to control you. And be careful of that. It's very different thinking. That's why I said it's a surprising idea, but it's very different thinking than the world will tell you. Second piece of advice. Your temptations, now listen carefully, your temptations are the result of your decisions, not your desires. Your temptations, gentlemen, are the result of your decisions, not your desires. Oh, you just have no idea. You know, the desires, you know, that's where my temptation's coming from, it's my desire. No, it's not. Your temptation's coming from the fact that you're standing in front of the wrong magazine rack, and that's a decision. Your temptation is coming from the fact that you got the wrong movie in your VCR, and that was a decision. Your temptation is coming from the fact that you pushed the wrong button on your computer. That was a decision. You make decisions, gentlemen. And what we do is we make bad decisions, then we whine about all the temptation we're under. Guys, get real. You know, yeah, desire is there. And yes, temptation is a part of being alive, but you make it so much worse when you make decisions. And I've never met a guy once, never once in 20 years of counseling, busted up lives on this subject, have I met a guy who was not responsible for his own temptation level by the decisions he was making. Don't blame it on her. Don't blame it on anybody else. Your temptations are the result of your own decisions. So, be proactive. Get rid of some of that stuff. In fact, get rid of all of it. If you got pornography under the seat in your car, get rid of it. You got stuff at the office you don't want your wife to see, get rid of it. Go there tomorrow morning and throw it away. Make a decision, or it will make a decision for you. I guarantee you. It will make a decision for you. It may already be making a decision for you. You may be part in this downward spiral we've been describing here. You got a computer? Either unplug it or change servers to Integrity Online or one of the and if you want numbers to find about how to do that, call our office. We'll give you the numbers to find. Make a decision. If you do not make a decision, your hormones will make a decision for you, and then do not whine to me about it. No, I can't believe this. Yeah, you should be able to believe it. Make the decision now, because your temptation is a result of your decisions, not just your desires. And that's exactly what's going on with this guy. That's why I showed you every place along the line. He let her do this, he let her do this, he let her do this, and he put himself in the position in the first place. Here's the third piece of advice. Your deliverance will be found. Your deliverance. If you're caught in a situation, you know, and I'm by caught, I mean not by someone else yet, but you know, you're saying to yourself, oh man, I'm the Lord is speaking to me here. Your deliverance will come from someone else's wisdom, not your own. Your deliverance, the ability to extricate yourself from this thing, will come because someone else will help you. Another mentor will help you. You will not be able to deal with it on your own, especially if you're deep into it. Here's what happens. Well, let me show you how it fits in the passage first. This foolish young man was completely without any accountability. He was thinking it all through on his own without any help. Yet there was a wise man right there in the story. And all this young man would have had to do was say, what am I doing wrong here? How come my life is goofed up? And with a little bit of accountability and a little bit of openness and taking a little bit of wisdom from somebody else, he could have actually been saved from the slaughterhouse, so to speak. So here's the point. If you're going to get out of this, it's going to be because someone else gives you wisdom and you listen to that. You have to allow yourself to take some advice. If you try and do it in secrecy and handle it all by yourself, it's not going to work real well, because yourself isn't a real good advisor, obviously. If you're already in the process, you're in trouble. Sexual promiscuity carries an anesthetic with it that numbs your brain. That's why this young guy gets dumber and dumber as time goes by. It numbs your brain. It makes you not think straight. The only one who can help you is someone who doesn't have a numb brain. Do you know anybody? And maybe you're hanging around with all people with numb brains. You know, it's entirely possible. There are people who do that. Everybody they know, their brain is numb. And, you know, every time they ask advice, the other person goes, you know. Find somebody who doesn't have a numb brain because of this and say, what shall I do? And they'll give you some advice, and then take the advice and be accountable to them. It'll save your skin. It'll save your skin. Came across this, a true story. This man telling his story, I'm just going to read what he says in this paragraph. When I was 14, a 14-year-old high school freshman, school was dismissed early for the teacher's meeting. I conveniently neglected to tell my parents about the change, and I arranged to bring my girlfriend over to my house. We were not planning to study. As we were going up the steps, my neighbor, Mrs. Nolan, poked her head out of the window and said, "You're home awfully early, Jerome." Can you see this? 14-year-old kid with his girlfriend is walking up the back steps. And Mrs. Nolan, she sticks her head out the window and says, "You're home early, Jerome." Can you imagine what's going on in a 14-year-old kid's head at that time? Oh, I love Mrs. Nolan. Isn't she sweet? No. He's seething. Yes, ma'am, I said, improvising a lame story about how we plan to review algebra problems. "Does your mother know you're home this early?" Mrs. Nolan persisted. See, old people are not stupid. "Does your mother know you're home this early? Would you like me to call her?" I love this lady. Now, see, this is wisdom from the window across the street. "Do you want me to call her?" I gave up. No, ma'am, I'll go inside. I'll call her while Kathy sits on the porch. Mrs. Nolan, and he goes on, he says, Mrs. Nolan saved our careers that day. If Kathy had gotten pregnant, she might not have become the doctor that she is today. And my father had warned me that if I made a baby, the mutual fund that he had set up for me to go to college or start a business would go to the child. Which is kind of a cool idea. I'm glad Mrs. Nolan was at her window looking out for me. That is really good. That is really good. You see, the wisdom that you need when sexual temptation is at its peak in your life, and it comes and goes, but the wisdom that you need, gentlemen especially, when sexual temptation is at its peak, is not going to come from you, and you're not going to be able to handle it on your own. You can tell yourself the truth all you want, and your body is going to walk up those steps like an ox to the slaughter. Someone else, you're going to have to let someone else in. You're going to have to let them say, what do you think you are doing? And this is not just true for young unmarried people, it's also true for married people. Married people need to be accountable to one another. The perfect person to be accountable to in these things is your wife. Another good person to be accountable to is a mentor. But men are so secretive. They will not let on. They won't open up about it. So gentlemen, advice. If you're going to extricate yourself from this, if you're going to deal with this like a wise man, the wisdom will not come from you. It will come from someone else, and you better open up to them. So, your sex drive is your responsibility, not hers. Your temptations are the result of your own decisions, not your desires. And your deliverance will be found in another person's wisdom, not your own. Let's bow our heads. Now, wisdom is not always easily acquired. We've had an entire talk this evening on an area of life that many people, if we had a show of hands, would say, you know, I've hurt myself that way, and I've hurt other people as well. Wisdom is hard to come by. We think that we can learn by just being in classrooms or just being in church, for instance. But let me tell you something. Just keep your eyes closed and think this through. You've heard some things from Proverbs tonight, and maybe some of them have spoken directly to who you are right now. I don't know that for sure, but it's possible that you're sitting here thinking, bingo, that hit me right where I am. But you have not entered into wisdom yet. You have heard wisdom in God's Word. You've had some advice based on that wisdom. And perhaps you sense the Lord has even spoken to you, but you have not entered wisdom yet. And you will not until you leave this place. Because wisdom is hard to come by. It means you have to make decisions. It means you have to actually go and do what you know is right, and you have to trust somehow that God is going to honor it. That is when wisdom begins, my friend. So if you're among those who might have been spoken to on this subject this evening, repenting now and determining to do something about it is only the first step. You must go back and do that which the Lord has said, and then you will have wisdom.